You are listening to Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances at the Los Angeles Central Library. I'm Louise Steinman from the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Today's conversation is part of Visualizing Language, Oaxaca in LA, an exhibition and program series presented by LFLA as part of the Getty's Pacific Standard Time, LALA initiative. From street art to Oaxacan cuisine, Visualizing Language presents free events throughout the city from September through January 2018. Visit lfla.org/Oaxaca to learn more, and please join us to see the new murals in Central Library or at a celebration of Oaxacan culture in a neighborhood library near you. One of the questions we're posing really is, why does language matter? Why should we care when a language goes extinct, when a massive, complex constellation of ideas, knowledge about time, seasons, sea creatures, flowers, landscapes, music, deer, the unknown and the everyday ceases to exist? What do we stand to lose? Or more accurately, do we even know what we stand to lose? And if a language dies out, can it be revitalized? Today's panelists care deeply about these questions, and they are addressing them in various and ingenious ways. And thanks to support to the Library Foundation from the Getty as part of their Pacific Standard Time LALA initiative, we're so thrilled to be able to assemble this extraordinary group of language activists to discuss both language extinction and language revival. As I said, I'm going to give very brief introductions to each of our guests, and you'll learn more about their work in the context of the conversation. And we will have time for you at the end to ask some questions. We will circulate microphones and ask that you wait until they come to you, as we do record for podcasts. Afterwards, we have a book signing in the lobby, and we hope you'll all stay and join us for a reception in the courtyard to peruse the marvelous Antenna Mobile, which is parked out there. We also have some books by our participants, courtesy of our library store in the lobby. And if you haven't already, we hope that you've taken the time, or that you will either later today or on some other day, to see the beautiful murals in the rotunda of the library, which are also part of this project, Visualizing Language, Oaxaca in LA. So starting to my immediate left is Leanne Hinton, our moderator today, Professor Emerita of Linguistics at UC Berkeley and advisory member of the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival. Leanne has long worked and written about the field of language revitalization and has helped design language learning methods now used worldwide. To her left, Vincent Medina, an Indigenous language activist and a leader in the movement to revive Chochenyo as a spoken language. Vincent has been a longtime contributor to the publication News from Native California and the author of the blog Being Ohlone in the 21st Century. In the middle there, we have Odilia Ramirez Hernandez, who is indigenous Zapotec from the Northern Mountains in the state of Oaxaca and is based here in Los Angeles. She's worked for many years with indigenous Mexican and binational organizations in the areas of human rights, cultural, and political education, and she's vice binational coordinator of FIOB, the Indigenous Front of Binational Organizations. To her left is Bob Holman, a veteran of the spoken word and slam poetry movement of the last several decades. Some of you might have seen the entirety of the documentary he co-produced and hosted, Language Matters, which we showed earlier today. Bob is joining us from his home in New York City today, and he is the co-founder and co-director, among many other hats, of the Endangered Language Alliance. And we have Virginia Carmelo, who has served as tribal chair and tribal council member of the Gabrielino Tongva Nation. We are on Tongva land, as Jen noted, the tribe indigenous to the Los Angeles Basin. And she's been working for many years to research and revitalize Tongva tribal song, dance, and regalia. It is such an honor to welcome you and to welcome our wonderful panelists. Please enjoy this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I think we'll be speaking for about an hour or a little less, perhaps, and then we will have time for questions as well. So I'm happy to see all of you, including people that I know some, and rest of you look very interesting. We're going to have the panelists reintroduce themselves, those who to say things that might have been left out. And we're hoping that those who speak an indigenous language will introduce themselves in their language, just so you can hear it. So we'll start with Vince.
Washatuhi makam kanakra kats Vince Medina kanakalkin saklan napa aye elamne taresh ekruak marote awash te nomo nehoshe nomo rote nomo te warep te tongva muakma yerote nomo rote ne warep tak kanak ukshere tak eknunu eknono aye ekmamham rote ek maknan irakat luis rote nomo aye kanak chocho te mariache leda luis aye bani medina ernestine gonzalez aye kanak inish te vince medina senior aye tina medina kish kanak rocket ashlip kanak rote nomo ne hoshe warap te himmen nesa. So hello to you all in my language, in Chochenyo, and I'm going to self-translate. What I said is, my name is Vince Medina. I am Ohlone. My homeland is north of here in the area of what we now call the East Bay, where Oakland and Berkeley is at today. That's my homeland. That's our indigenous home where we're descended from. I work with my language. I work to revive these words of my culture, words that haven't been spoken in my family for about 70 years. And my generation, guided by our elders, have worked tirelessly to bring these words back home. I work with language as part of a process of decolonization of our culture, and language is one part of this, but it's connected to many other elements such as food, stories, song, dances, many other things that would be spoken about. And I said, I'm grateful to be here in the land of the Tongva, where Virginia is indigenous to, and glad to be here with you all. Thank you.
Padius Nedaria Odilia Romero. Zua Shujo, Bener Shujo Neda. Na Zua Los Angeles, Yesh Chebeneula Ganis. Yesh Tabeseke. My name is Odilia Romero. I'm from the community of Sogocho. I live here in Los Angeles. In Los Angeles, the city that now is belongs to the people that crossed the oceans, but originally belonged to the Tongvas.
Hi, I'm Bob Holman. Pico is a Hawaiian word that means, among other things, the place where your parents buried your umbilical cord. So the next time somebody asks you where you're from, just tell them that your parents buried your umbilical cord wherever you figure they would have. You know, in Hawaii, it's different. I'm a poet, and poets have been using language for thousands of years rent-free. And now it's payback time. As languages disappear, poets lose the stuff that they need to work with. My mother was is the daughter of a Kentucky coal miner. She married the only Jew in Harlan, Kentucky, where she and my father, Benjamin, whose parents came from Kamenets-Podolsky in Ukraine, buried my Pico. And I'm honored to be here.
Meiha weene hiken netwanya ne Virginia Carmelo awesh kone ekwaare. Hello everyone. I'm Virginia Carmelo, and I'm happy you're all here today. I am Tongva Gabrielino, and our ancestral lands are the entire Los Angeles Basin, including the Four Channel Islands in our ocean over here to the west. And I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. So one of the things that we want to get across today is that there's an enormous diversity of languages in the world and in North America. It's listed as about 170 indigenous languages that are endemic to the United States. And I heard the number 65 or 66 in Mexico, except that's an undercount because when you look at, for example, Zapotec, actually many people that speak Zapotec speak a language that's different enough from each other that they can't understand each other. So even Zapotec is more of a language family. And so in California alone, there's over 80 indigenous languages. So about half the languages of the United States are here in California. And yet, most of them have no speakers anymore. And if they do have speakers, it's maybe one or two or three who are quite elderly. We've lost several of the last speakers of their languages just in this year. We're seeing the decline as we go. So a lot is lost when we lose a language. And I sort of want to start out with the question, though, of a lot of people say, well, why don't we all speak English anyway? Because then we can communicate with each other better and you don't have to have translators and so forth. But there's a beauty in language diversity. And I wonder if any of you would like to just speak about that beauty. I know Bob, for example, is like me, that we're language collectors. We love all languages. I'm from the linguistic end of things, and he's from the poetic end of things. But language diversity itself seems to have a lot of advantages, even despite the disadvantages that people see about communication. Bob, what would you have to say about that?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is I've just seen some photos backstage of Vincent's new culinary linguistic IPO, you know, and looking at the incredible acorn flatbreads and delicious duck breasts in raspberry sauce or some, I don't know, some berry sauce. Sort of made me hungry. And I realized I was getting hungry for what these foods were called and what they were about and where they came from. So I'm going to toss that dish right back over to you, Vincent. How do you get from this formal setting of talking about language to sitting down in front of a luncheon of duck breast and acorn bread?
Well, language got me to duck by many different ways, but the one way is by connecting many different aspects of culture that's grounded and rooted in the foundation of language. Now, we know that in my history, in my community, which is similar to many histories of people who were affected by the California missions, it's been about over 200 years of people trying to take our cultures from us, trying to take our languages, our foods, our stories, trying to take the things that are indigenous to this place from us, to try to assimilate us to be Western, to be more like people who are colonizing and conquering this place. The thing, though, is that our ancestors, just like ourselves today, never wanted to give up those things that matter. We didn't want to give up our languages. That's why they're documented. We didn't want to give up these stories that stretch back to the very beginning of time. We didn't want to give up these foods that our ancestors cherished and loved. We didn't want to give up any of these things that matter to us. And our ancestors, just like our elders today, found and continue to find ways to keep these things alive in the spite of extreme hardships that our communities have to face. Hardship that's not simply in the past, but sustained and still continuing in the present form today in 2017 as well. And so connecting back to duck, though, from language, inside of these ethnographic notes that exist, thousands of pages of ethnographic notes that our elders, that our ancestors left for us that were recorded in the 1920s and 30s, handwritten, scribbled down, because these people were the last of their speakers, the last of that generation that could remember these old words that have been spoken for us since the very beginning. Inside of these notes, they left much more than language, but they left stories. They left creation. They left their memories of creation. They left our values embedded in those old notes. They talked about the injustice that our community saw. They talked about the foods that they loved. They talked about ways to gather. They talked about every little bit that they could talk about that was relevant to keeping our culture alive, because they knew it was meant to continue. And so when we eat these foods, these old foods, it's a part of the decolonization process that I mentioned when I was introducing myself, is we don't want just simply language back, but we want everything back. We want one day all Ohlone children in my community to have Ohlone language in their lives, to have these stories that our ancestors connected to, that ground us in our religion and in our values, told again. People want our foods cooked again at every single dinner table. They want our values instilled so that they'll last forever. This was the goal of our people, and this goal is still continuing. We still want this. It's not over. And so being able to eat these foods along with language, being a part of them, connects us to our people through taste. We taste those same flavors that they tasted. We commune with them in this way. And when we add language to it, when we say this duck, it's not called duck, but it's called shakani. This berry sauce, it's not called berry sauce, but it's called enismin shakani. When we add these things to the language, we have this holistic experience of reconnecting back into that old world. And we feel stronger connected to our ancestors. And it makes us collectively stronger. So in that way, duck is connected to language. But many other things besides duck come from language as well.
Yeah. Well, Odelia has... I've also seen in our conversations with you just in the last few hours that language and culture is just not separable. That... And for you, there's language. You also have a food aspect to cultural maintenance here in Los Angeles, and you have issues of justice and the culture of Zapotec culture and the difficulties, for example, of translating into English what the Zapotec people here are experiencing, and the difficulties of translating for them. The completely different culture of say, the courts here in California. If you'd like to talk a little bit about what you've experienced with language and all aspects of culture that you're trying to deal with here.
Bueno, el idioma o la lengua es una parte importante del ser humano. Nosotros no podemos dejar los que hablamos la lengua, los que todavía la tenemos, no debemos permitir que nos hagan ver el mundo de un solo color. Al hablar inglés y todos hablar inglés en el mundo, estaríamos viendo el mundo a través del mundo occidental. Ya no estaríamos viendo muchos mundos. Es una obligación, es un deber continuar esas lenguas. Ustedes no pueden comer pan todos los días y el mismo sabor de trigo. Sería muy aburrido la vida. Igual no pueden comer frijoles todos los días, las tres comidas. Sería muy aburrido, ¿cierto? Así sería nuestro mundo sin todas las lenguas del mundo. Así sería mi mundo sin zapoteco. Desde que ellos llegan, lo primero que atacan es la comida y nuestra lengua. Lo primero que pierdes el otro día, les voy a contar, estaba platicando con alguien y me dice, oye, y pues en mi idioma se dice la Virgen, Ronar. Entonces hice una publicación en mi muro y les pregunto, ¿qué significa Ronar, en tu zapoteco? Y todo el mundo me decía virgen. En nuestro mundo, la virgen no existe. Entonces fuimos cambiando y le fuimos dando un concepto diferente a que sea la Virgen María. Pero Shonash es lo máximo de una mujer. Si tú te refieres a tu abuelita, puede ser tu Shonash o tu Virgen si tú quieres, pero es lo máximo. Desde ese entonces nos cortan una parte, nos obligan a cambiar el significado de nuestras lenguas. Hay uno muy, muy, muy seguido que se usa, que es Benewaya, brujo. ¿Qué cosa tan más horrible? Un brujo. Pero si tú descifras, Bene es persona, Wa es cargar, Ya es día, contador del día, un hombre que sabe el calendario. ¿De dónde sacamos que es brujo? Lo sacamos porque así nos lo impusieron y nos obligaron a mirarnos diferentes desde nuestra espiritualidad, obligándonos Virgen Ronash, Benewasha, brujo. Nos obligan a cambiar todo desde la perspectiva de ellos. Nos obligan a vernos menos. ¡Qué horror! Es un brujo. Pero nunca más se le da el respeto del contador del día, el hombre que cuenta los días, el calendario de los pueblos. Igual pasa con la comida. Nos empiezan a cambiar desde el amaranto, nos traen harina. Entonces todo eso enferma nuestro espíritu, nuestra alma, pero lo hacen con el idioma. El idioma es lo principal. Cuando a mí me sacan de mi pueblo, me arrancaron de una raíz, como la zanahoria. Tiene sus raíces muy arraigadas en el suelo. Cuando la arrancas, queda pedacitos colgados. Nosotros que fuimos desplazados a Los Ángeles, nos queda ese pedacito delgado de esas raíces colgadas de la zanahoria o del rábano o del maíz, lo que quieras. Y tenemos la obligación de darle vida. Hay que ponerlo en un vaso y echarle agua para que vuelva a nacer. Porque volviendo a nacer, volvemos a ver el mundo zapoteco. Volvemos a pensar, a vivir y a comer un zapoteco. Siempre, ¿por qué no podernos tomar un rico pozoncle? Es muy nutritivo. Tiene cacao, tiene esta raíz que es la cocolmeca, que corta la grasa naturalmente. ¿Por qué tenemos que ir a un café, no voy a decir nombres, a tomarte un latte? No entiendo. Y digo, ¿por qué no tomarte un atole hecho de granos, pero vas y te tomas otra cosa? ¿Por qué no tomarte un mezcal en vez de ir a tomar otra cosa? Entonces nos matan la comida. El idioma se pierde con la comida y la comida se pierde con el idioma. Y sin el idioma también muere nuestro espíritu. El idioma es parte de nuestra vida diaria y nosotros que hablamos el zapoteco, es obligatorio, es un deber rescatarlo. No podemos andar como la zanahoria sin raíces, sin las hojitas encima, porque seríamos un hueco, seríamos un ser humano sin raíz y sin la espiritualidad y sin el pensamiento zapoteco.
Thank you.
Could I just add something? For myself, as a person who is learning my indigenous language, one of the things that is important to know is that there are not ways to express things from one language to another always. Sometimes you can get the gist of them, and I'm not talking about one word, I'm talking about an idea or a phrase or something referring to something. Sometimes there's just no way to translate it. And I'm sure this is true of not just indigenous languages, but other languages too throughout the world. So what happens as part of that is that you come to realize, for myself, that it also verifies that our ways are very distinct
to who we are as a people. So, for instance, if you take words that have to do with land, it's not just land or a piece of soil or a piece of earth. It actually has to do with our beings and where our people come from. So that's a very different and grand idea to have to explain with just one word. So that's just a little added from my experience.
Well,
I was just going to say, the problems are in the subtleties of the language, right? That you can translate anything into any language. It's just that there is something that gets lost in the translation. I mean, there are very rare times where there are concepts that can't be translated. The way that the Language Matters film opens up is with Charlie Mangalda, the last speaker of Amardok, this Aboriginal language. And in Amardok, there's no left or right in that language. Now, this is a concept that really gets deep into the consciousness. And if we lose Amardok and other languages like it, the few languages like it, we would not know that there are actually people who don't always think that the individual is the center of the universe. The only way that you can tell Charlie Mangalda when you're filming him, actually this is a little bit of a joke, you have to say to him, Charlie, would you mind moving your foot a little bit more to the southwest? Because in Amardok, it's only the cardinal directions that orient you to the universe. So what does it mean to have a language where you ain't it? Can you imagine that? Even just imagining it is such a wonderful thing, such a liberating thing, to think these people could care less about how you're oriented. It's how the world is around you. You know, and at lunch today, I got to go back to this food thing one more time. You know, Odelia was talking about a case that I hope that she might bring up, where she was saying that in Zapotec, there's no word for ounce. You know, and this became really important in a court case. You know what I'm talking about?
Sí, sí lo sé, Bob. Bueno, en el mundo indígena, en el mundo zapoteco, por lo menos en el mío, tampoco se usa mucho el derecho y el izquierdo. De hecho, se dice gichriyesh, rangyesh. O sea, la cabeza del pueblo o la parte es lo mismo. Y eso es en sí con muchos pueblos. Dice rangyesh, gichriyesh, y en muchos en la numerología no es que no tengamos, tenemos números, contamos de a 20, pero en el caso occidental, en este caso particular de lo que estábamos hablando en la mañana, a la mamá de este bebé le dicen que le dé en onzas. Ella no habla español, habla muy poco español, y ella no siguió las indicaciones. Y cuando yo le digo al juez, no la siguió porque el mundo en onzas no existe. Le tienes que mostrar tanto del vaso o tanto de leche, pero no le puedes decir a alguien que no habla español en onzas. Eso no les importó, la familia perdió sus niños, porque es un mundo diferente. Y los jueces se preguntan, ¿cómo que no pueden tener onzas? ¿Cómo que el zapoteco es zapoteco como el español, como el inglés? Pues no, no es así. El zapoteco es único en cada variante, y nuestra manera de ver la vida es muy diferente. Y esto pone muchas barreras aquí en las ciudades. Puede ser la ciudad de Oaxaca, puede ser la ciudad de México, puede ser aquí en Los Ángeles, en Nueva York. El no entender nuestro mundo te hace juzgarnos que nosotros somos unos burros y que no sabemos y que no entendemos la vida y que no podemos hacer ciertas cosas. Y no es que no las podamos hacer. Si tú me las pides hacerla en mi idioma, yo claro que te las voy a hacer. Si tú me lo explicas en mi idioma, no es que yo sea tonta. Tu idioma y el mío no se parecen. Tu mundo y el mío no nada tienen que ver. Pero tú me juzgas, porque eso es lo que pasa cuando uno se encuentra a los tribunales, a los sistemas escolares de Estados Unidos o cualquier ciudad donde no conocen que existen otros idiomas. hay muchos perjuicios hacia las comunidades indígenas de todos lados. Entonces, automáticamente a esta familia le quitan sus hijos porque no muestra cariño, porque no lo abraza, porque no le dice cosas que el occidental dice. Y eso es una injusticia que pasa todos los días en todos los tribunales de Estados Unidos, en las escuelas, donde los niños se van al sistema de cuidado, a este sistema tan cruel, porque entonces los niños llegan a un mundo que no conocen, un mundo donde no hablan su idioma, donde no comen su comida, y salen súper traumatizados de esto. No puedo dar muchos detalles del caso en tan público, pero es una de las cosas más dolorosas que yo he visto, que por el idioma, por el perjuicio, tanto del intérprete del español como de otros latinoamericanos, quitarle la niña a una familia es una crueldad solo por su idioma.
Notion of an ounce is simply a whole different notion than the kind of weights that that other languages might use in other cultures. And there's a lot of difference. There's, for example, Yurok has no north, south, east, west, because they live on rivers, and the only way to get any place is to go up river or down river. And so their focus is on the rivers and on the hills around the rivers rather than on the cardinal directions. So there's just so many differences. And I'm sure that now with Vince and with Virginia, they had to learn their language as adults. They didn't learn their language as kids. It had been a generation or two generations or more since anyone had spoken their language. And I thought I'd ask you to begin, Virginia, with sort of how did you learn your languages and what were some of the aha moments of learning the different concepts that came with your language?
You know, this journey wasn't one that I chose. It just kind of, you know, the path was there and I followed it. And the Breath of Life conference that you host, Leanne, of course, was one of the door openers for me. My line of thinking was, I just want to learn a couple of words so I can sing a song or say a prayer. A very simple goal, right? But as I became connected with the different people who could help me, including, I call her my linguist, but she's not mine. It's Pam Monroe. She's out of UCLA, and she's basically been working with our group now for over 12 years. I don't know. And what we're doing is, as a linguist, she's helping us learn how to say the words, how to pronounce them. There's very little that's recorded, but there is some, so we do have an idea. But it's basically studying it, but it, more than that, it's being able to practice it. So in my case, when I first started to speak, I kind of took it like the same way when I learned Spanish. I learned Spanish as an adult, and it clued me into a lot of different, I guess, concepts or ways that people who speak Spanish in Mexico, and for me it was Mexico City, clued me into what the character of the people was like because of the language. So I kind of took the same thing and said, okay, if I can learn how to distinguish if the people are talking in the past or in the present, then it kind of gives me a heads up onto what we're talking about. So taking that, it actually did help me to learn a little bit faster, I think, because I was able to say, okay, this is now and this was then. And I kind of just stuck to those two things. But when I was able to also share the language with my grandchildren, I started with my children, but they're all adults, and they were interested and they responded, but the children are much more natural. So I was able to use my grandchildren as, you know, the people that I'm conversing with. And since I was able to do that, I think it really helped me to really take in these things, because if I wanted to be able to say whatever, you know, whatever the phrase was to that grandchild, I had to have it in me. And so I had to make sure it was there so that I would say it properly the first time.
Because if I said it wrong the first time, yeah, I can correct it, but it's not the same for the child because they're going to throw it back at me right the same way that I gave it to them. So it really, you know, made me want to be more sure of how I was using the words, and it was just amazing. It was just amazing to see them come back with the same way. And now, you know, I have a 15-year-old, and when his little brother was born, I think he was maybe 7 or 8, and so I started the same thing, talking to the little brother, the baby, as he was learning, and then to hear him say the same thing that I said to the baby, it was like, oh, whoa, wait, I didn't expect that, you know, but it's just a more fulfillment, but, you know, it's continuing, and it's sometimes, you know, of course, it's frustrating because I don't know it all, but it's very fulfilling also, and to also see that the grandchildren are picking it up it's just overwhelming. I can't even express that, but... you know, what I am very thankful for is that it is continuing, and I have the time and the resources and the energy to continue doing that.
Maybe just to say a little bit more about Breath of Life for people who haven't heard of it before.
Yeah.
This is something that we do up in Berkeley that every other year we have a gathering of California Indians who come to find materials on their languages that are in the archives. So Berkeley and many other institutions have a long history of anthropologists and linguists who have documented the endangered languages of the United States. And Berkeley has one of the, if not the largest collection of materials on California Indian languages anywhere. So the participants each get to work with a linguist who can help them figure out what the words on paper are all about. And then they're on their own to go ahead and learn their languages. So this conference had a little bit about, I think what path to extinction or a threat of extinction. And people at Breath of Life have said, we do not like to use the word extinct. That, first of all, the people are not extinct. And secondly, if a language has any kind of documentation, it can be revitalized. And so that's what's happening in California, is that languages are being revitalized through either through documentation, or if there are still a few speakers left, there's programs that our group, Vince and I both belong to, the Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, and our group is trying to provide methods for people to learn their languages from the speakers, and also how to use them, right? That's the issue. You can learn a language, but if you're not passing it on, if you don't have anybody to talk to, that language is not really going to survive beyond you. And so language transmission is another important part of language revitalization. Vince, do you have some things you'd like to add about language learning from scratch?
Yeah. Well, as Leanne said, my language, I had to relearn the words. I wasn't raised speaking Chochenyo. Chochenyo is something that I began to connect with when I was a few words when I was a teenager, but then the bulk of it when I was in my early 20s. And I always wondered what our language sounded like. And I come from a really old Indian family from the East Bay. My family's never left the East Bay. We've stayed exactly where our homeland's at in spite of everything that's happened. And that's something that we all have a lot of pride in. I grew up knowing my identity, knowing my connection to that land, knowing that I belong there, and knowing that I'm Ohlone, knowing that I'm a native person. But a lot of the specifics of our culture, we didn't know. Like, our baskets weren't woven. A lot of those old songs weren't sung. Our food wasn't eaten, and our language wasn't spoken. So I had a lot of family to go to and a lot of elders that I could go to ask questions. And for me, one of the people I've always gone to is my grandmother. And I asked her, I asked her questions about our language. And she told me that I should learn. She encouraged me to go and learn. So I started working with simple word list at first, where I just barely began to understand what the language sounded like. Little bits of words that I was at first even afraid to pronounce because I knew I was going to pronounce them incorrectly. But that was really my first glimpse into what our language sounded like. And then I was working with a good friend of mine named Linda Yamane, who is a basket weaver from the Ohlone area. And she introduced me to thousands of pages of notes from this linguist named John Peabody Harrington, who went around California and especially focused on areas in the Chumash area and the Ohlone area along the central coast. And he went to my community in the 1920s and 30s and recorded people who were living in the same area that my family was living in, the exact same space over in an area called Sinol in the old Rancheria. That's where my great-grandmother was born. And in that place, there were two old-timers that were living there who could remember our language, and they knew enough of it to record as much as they could. Their names were Angela de los Colos and Jose Guzman. They were both elderly people, both in their 70s, and they were recorded just about at the end of their lives, both of them. And they sat down and they shared as much as they could, not just about language, but as I said earlier, about every other part of culture that they could remember. And they told these things with this urgency, as if, you know, if they weren't going to record it, that these things would just be forgotten. And if they didn't record these things, they likely wouldn't continue at all today. But they recorded these things with this urgency because they knew that they were the ones that were going to save this language. And they did. Today, as a result of their efforts, we can pick up those old notes and learn these words again. We can sit down with linguists and train ourselves to be linguists, to work with these notes and understand how to take these off the pages and how to speak them again in our homeland. And it's not just simply taking words off pages and speaking them, but it's a holistic healing experience for my community. Because when we're speaking these words that are meant to be spoken within the area that we originate from, when we use these words in the same places that our ancestors use these words, when we use these languages together, these words cut together collectively, we use them when we're reviving other aspects of our culture, we use them socially, we use them on Facebook and Twitter, you know, we use them on Instagram, we use them in every medium we can, what it does is it allows us to be able to remember these, to hold these close to us, to hold these close to our hearts. And then when we use these words, it also, in so many ways, it gives us that respect for our old timers who had those words taken from them. We're able to bring back something that so many people had stolen from them forcibly because other people didn't want them to speak those words. There was an old timer who passed away named Phil Galvin, who was a relative of mine. He was born on the old Rancheria, and he remembered hearing the language spoken at the very beginning of his life. He passed away, he was born in the early 1920s. In the beginning years of his life, he could hear Chochenyo spoken in the Rancheria. And for most of his life, because it stopped being spoken when he was a child, there was about 70, 80 years that the language wasn't spoken. And in the last years of his life, he heard the language spoken again by people in our family. He heard the language be used not just simply, you know, in small ways, but being strung into conversations, being made into speeches, being published into literature, being made into all kinds of things that shows that this is a living language again. And I remember one day he pulled me aside and he told me, he said, "I'm glad I live long enough to hear it a second time." So it reminds us, you know, that things, when they're not fair, there's ways to repair them, to make them better. And when I go and work with my language to revive these words, I know I'm doing it for those old timers, for the people who had those words taken from them, for our ancestors, but also for the future generations that are coming, that they'll be able to grow up in a world where this language is just spoken. And already this is happening. And I'll give you one example. I have a little brother, and he's 14 years old. And his name is Gabriel. And ever since he was 7 years old, he's been learning the Chochenyo language. And he has conversational fluency in the language right now. And now he's teaching younger members of our family these words on his own. So it gives me a lot of pride to be able to know what's possible when those seeds are planted and those seeds are with good intentions to bring back things, to be able to continue this culture. Then it shows that with the right energy that it's possible to make this happen, not just to revive, but to be able to continue the way that things are meant to be. So it brings me a lot of pride to be able to do that.
You know, I think Odelia is in the opposite end of language loss, that she's a native speaker of Zapotec, didn't even learn Spanish or English until she came to the United States, right? What she's trying to do is to save the Zapotec language when it's in diaspora, where people are no longer in their homeland, and yet in L.A., can we save Zapotec in L.A.? Would you say a few words about that?
Bueno, yo creo que el zapoteco tiene mucho futuro aquí en Los Ángeles. Porque si bien no estamos en nuestras tierras, habemos miles de zapotecos aquí. Y aquí en Los Ángeles existe la diversidad más grande de la lengua zapoteca. Y creo yo, bueno, yo espero que estos movimientos que se empiezan de la lengua zapoteca tenga un fruto de que se continúe el idioma. Tenemos toda una generación, la mía y una más, siguiente a la mía, que hablamos el idioma, que nos trajeron aquí de niños. Entonces, como decía hace rato, es nuestra obligación continuar hablando el idioma aquí en Los Ángeles, pero sí tiene un gran futuro. Ahora la nueva generación, mi generación, cuando llegamos aquí, pues no hablábamos español, porque en el pueblo, en el caso mío, nos rehusábamos a aprender el español. Nos pegaban con carrizos para aprender el español. Y una cosa que hacíamos los niños, la maestra era de un pueblo vecino que se llama Yalina, y empezábamos a decir, Becoshuahue, o sea, la perra de Yalina nos quiere pegar. Y nos salíamos corriendo. Nos resistíamos a hablar el castellano. Ya, pero cuando llegamos aquí, nos encontramos que nadie nos entiende, que nadie quiere hablar con nosotros, y nos preguntaban, ¿eres indio? Y decíamos, ajá. ¿Eres mexicano? Ajá. Porque en realidad no sabíamos ni que era indio, ni que era indígena, ni que era mexicano. Porque para nosotros yo era Benerrucho, Beneyeu. O sea, yo soy de Sogocho, la persona que vive a la gente del río. Pero aquí de pronto soy mexicana, soy indígena, soy india. Y yo siempre digo a la gente, bueno, si a ti te hace feliz hacerme chicana, mexicana, latina, hispana, adelante. Pero yo sé que yo soy Sogochens. Yo sé que yo soy Benerjoshu. Y eso no me lo van a quitar. Y esa generación se rehusó a enseñarle el zapoteco a sus hijos. Por tanto, racismo y discriminación que enfrentó, no solo de un nuevo sistema, pero de los mismos mexicanos. Porque habría que reconocer que los mexicanos son muy racistas. Y digo los mexicanos, porque les repito, yo soy Benerjoshu. Yo no soy mexicana. No vengo de la nación mexica. Vengo de Sogocho. Y eso decíamos, pero ¿por qué no entendíamos el por qué el maltrato o por qué las risas? Yo viví muy cerca de aquí de la biblioteca y cuando iba a la escuela los niños me veían y decían, y yo decía, okay. Pero no entendía que era una burla. Y ya mucho después me di cuenta pues que sí se estaban burlando. Entonces esa generación decidió no enseñar el zapoteco. Una meta fue aprender el inglés, dominar el inglés y que tus hijos se fueran a la escuela ya hablando inglés para no sufrir ese bullying o esa discriminación que sufren hoy las comunidades y que siempre han sufrido las comunidades indígenas. Pero los hijos de esa generación ahora quieren aprender. Y eso nos da muchas esperanzas. Esos hijos quieren aprender el idioma. Los nietos de esa generación, en el caso de mi nieta, a ella sí le interesa aprender el idioma. Su mamá ya no se lo enseñamos, pero a su hija sí lo quiere aprender. Entonces, esa nueva generación tiene mucha esperanza, y si existe la esperanza de aquí, se pueda salvar y pueda, yo no diría, sería la continuación del zapoteco, porque el zapoteco ha estado en resistencia y en lucha por más de 526 años. Y si contamos que alguna vez nos quisieron conquistar los aztecas, bueno, lleva mucho más años de lucha. Pero aquí seguimos 526 años después en Los Ángeles tratando de continuar el idioma. Y creo que esa semilla ha dado, ya está dando sus primeros frutos, ¿no? Y hay varios grupos enseñando el zapoteco de diferentes variantes aquí. Y esa es la idea, que podamos continuar hablando el zapoteco. Hoy me puedo encontrar a alguien en el autobús y está en su celular hablando en zapoteco. Hoy me puedo encontrar a alguien tranquilamente tener su huipil en la ciudad de Los Ángeles puesto, algo que dejamos de hacer en los 80. Dejamos de hablar el idioma, dejamos de usar la ropa y hoy tranquilamente se puede ver a la gente andar. El otro día venía en el autobús y dice el señor, fui a la fiesta, pero ¿qué crees? La comida ni estuvo buena. Era una variante que yo entendía y me puse a reír yo solita y él se volteó y se dio cuenta. Entonces ya como que, ¿y ahora qué digo? Me entendió. Entonces eso me da mucho gusto encontrarlo. Entonces creo hay mucha esperanza de que aquí vuelva a continuar el zapoteco en las nuevas generaciones.
Great. So, Bob, there's... I want this off when I'm talking. I think people would like to hear a little bit about the organization that you work with in New York.
Yeah, the Endangered Language Alliance is devoted. We have an urban field station where we do a lot of recording of languages. We're attempting to make a language census of New York City. We estimate that there are over 800 languages in the five boroughs, and we've enumerated up to 400 now, and almost 100 of them are endangered languages or treasure languages, as some people like to call them. And for me, it's a wonderful town meeting place, sort of like this room in here, where all these languages cross over. We have classes in Lenape, for example, the original language of Manhattan. Anushik, we say in Lenape when we're greeting people. You know, what I love hearing today is people in their mother tongues telling us who they are. And for us to listen to the truth of who they are in the way that the individual speaks. If you don't hear it that way, you ain't getting it straight. And, you know, I want to love this country. I want to love these United States because this is the place where mongrels like all of us, except a few of us, can come and find a home, but to find a home with the people who lived here originally is a lot different from the way that we were taught and the way that colonialism occupied these lands. Now, at the very least, we can help these languages and cultures that have managed to survive these centuries to find themselves again, for these identities to be realized and for these languages to be heard. I want to challenge all of you to look into your own pasts and find the languages of your past wherever they are. I'm going to bet that most of you have, within a few generations, a so-called endangered language yourself back there. You know, my grandparents, as I mentioned on the one side, came from Ukraine. They spoke Yiddish. You know, the Hebrew, the language of Israel, was quote extinct for 700 years before the Jews decided to have that this had to be the language of Israel, the official language. And it was brought back to life so that now it is the language of that country. Unfortunately, the spoken languages of that time, like my grandparents spoke Yiddish, and then there's Ladino for the Sephardic Jews, those languages now are endangered because Yiddish was brought back and became the official language. So the spoken languages of the shtetl are, you can't hear them so much anymore, though people are trying to bring those back as well. It's complicated, right? But Ukrainian, that my grandparents also spoke, was always a minority language in Ukraine. Russian was the primary language, or for the last 150 years or so, until 10 years ago. Until a few years ago, when Putin grabbed Crimea, and people said, wait a minute, why are we speaking Russian? And without any endangered language alliance or any other movement, people decided on their own it was time to pick up Ukrainian again and speak it. And now Ukrainian is the majority language in Ukraine and not Russian. You all have these stories in your own languages. On the other side, Sally, my mother, the child of the coal miner, if you'll remember, is from Wales. And so when I went to Welsh and learned that the town that my relatives lived in was Thanvair put Gwynguith Gogera Quirin Drobetlata Hilio Gogoroch, the little town with the long name, it helped me in learning a little bit of Welsh to do in that movie also. Who you are is those languages of all of our lineages. You know, yes, it's English is a great language for us to communicate in. But when you're with a lot of indigenous people and you say, what languages do you speak? English isn't mentioned because languages mean who you are. And English is a great way of getting along. We need it. It's a fantastic language. I've got 10 books in it. One is available, blah, blah, blah. But who you are those languages that you come from. So the Endangered Language Alliance in New York, if we can even use that word, I don't know, but at any rate, is a place where all those languages can come together and commune, and in its way kind of mirrors what's going on here today.
Thank you, Bob. We're going to stop in just a moment and ask for questions, but I just thought I would ask Virginia to say the last word as the person whose land we're on. What do you envision for your language, for the future of your language?
You know, it's I'm one person, but I always think of everyone else, and by everyone else I mean all my tribal members, all my tribal families, both going back, all the ancestors, and going forward, all the children and the young people. And that's the way we're taught to think. And when I started with the language, I remember being very disappointed because, okay, I can learn a few words, but there's not an entire language. At this point, you know, however many years later, I look at it and I think, I'm never going to get to the end of it. It's just so much. But, you know, I get a lot of inspiration, I think, from when I think about the elders. When I worked with the tribe, I was able to speak with a lot of families. And every time I would meet an elder, I would always ask them, do you speak the language? Did you hear the language? Did you ever hear it? And I asked many people, and I only got one person that answered, and he said, yes, I remember my grandmother said these words to me, and he spoke them. And that alone just made it all come alive to me and make the connection. So for me, it's all about connections. And when I share with the children, it's all about helping them to connect with who they are as a person, who their family was, who their ancestors were. When we look at the landscape, and we're in an urban area, and Vince and I were talking about this, it's very difficult when you are in a giant urban area. And when I was a child, it wasn't all urban. It was still developing. There was still a lot of open land. But one of the things I try to bring across to the children is that this is your land. We take care of it. And this is how you call your land. And I'm able to tell them, Hai for the mountains. I'm able to tell them Momte for the ocean. I'm able to tell them Wenot for the rivers. And these are the words they're starting to use. And for me, that's the blessing that we all get, is to be able to have a continuance onto the future of who our people are. And like Leanne says, we're not extinct. We're still here. And we still want to be a part of this wonderful land and be the caretakers of it. And the language is just one of the aspects that's helping us carry it into the future for our children.
Thank you. So we'd like to open up to questions that any of you have. And I think there's going to be a mic passed around, too, for people that have questions.
Cultures have?
It's not on. There you go.
Hi. What I was going to ask is, is there one word that you actually share? I mean, is there one word that goes through generations in different cultures? One.
I'm sorry. Say it again.
It's like hi. You could say hi in all your different ways. Is similar. Like no. No is a word that is said through all languages.
Uh-huh.
Is there one word for you guys that has almost the same way?
Almost the same way to say hello.
Well,
I should say, by the way, that I'll start if you don't mind. Maybe everybody would like to answer, but I went to we were studying Mixtec once at Berkeley, and we asked the speaker, how do you say hello? And he said, well, you don't. You know, we know everybody. <You know? laughs> So, we might say, how's your family, or something like that, but we're not going to say hello. And I had the same experience with the Havasupais, which are in Arizona, when there was no word for hello in the language. There now is, because people have taken on some of the culture of English. And so they'll say gamyu now in Havasupai, which means how are you? But normally, it said, since you know everybody, why do you say hello? You might say, I'd say, well, what do you say when you meet somebody on the path? And they'd say, oh, I'd say, where are you going? So maybe some of you have other answers to hello.
I do. I'd like to share. So when I began, I said, meiha. And it goes pretty much along the same line. There really is no way to say hello in our language. And what we do say for the greeting is meiha, or sometimes just mei. And basically, it means, how's it going? Where are you going? What's happening with you? So there's no need to say hello because the door's already open. Now it's like, okay, what's going on? You know, how's it going? So I kind of, when I discovered this meaning, I kind of looked at it with like, you know, our young people. They say, hey, what's up?
What's up?
What's up? That's all it is. You know, it's like, tell me about you. You know, here we are face to face. Now tell me about you. You know, so it's getting past, you know, the formal, greeting, and it's past that.
Well, I'll do one in Welsh. Hoel is hi and also goodbye. But I want to tell you how it's spelled. It's spelled Hwyl. Hoel. Okay? Now, this is the Welsh love to use the Greek alphabet like we all are using, right? Except that they don't, you have to relearn what every sound means in it. This is because they live in Cymru. Cymru, which means, which is the way the Welsh say Wales. C-Y-M-R-U. Cymru. Got it? Now, here's my question to you. How come the whole world calls, or in the English-speaking world, calls Wales, Wales, which is a Saxon word that means those other guys? So in Wales, they, the way they have to speak when they're speaking English is, we are those other guys. Why can't we be ourselves? Because if we're ourselves, we would be living in Cymru. Thank you. Hoyle.
Well, with us, there is a word, but it's, bueno, con nosotros, hay una palabra que se usa, para Dios, pero ese es un préstamo del español. Entonces, pero usualmente si te encuentras una persona en el camino, pases a, ya vienes, o gachero, o para dónde vas, ya, pero ya con los españoles ya se pidió prestado esa palabra de padiur, bases a, es lo equivalente a hola, ya vienes, o hola, para dónde vas, pero teniendo en cuenta que ese es un préstamo del español.
I'm wishing I'd paid more attention to my grandparents who spoke Maltese, but the question I have for you is, how do you deal with the special considerations of preserving indigenous languages when dealing with a deaf community?
There are many endangered deaf languages of the deaf, many endangered sign languages in particular. And perhaps that's not what you meant, though, of dealing with the deaf community. Okay. there's so many sign languages that have been developed in local areas, especially when there's a large percentage of deaf people, which sometimes happens in isolated communities, that there is maybe 10 or 20% even of the community that might be deaf. And so there's a lot of these local languages, and there are linguists that are trying to document these languages. And what happens sometimes, for example, I think in Nicaragua, in Nicaragua, there's a deaf language, a deaf sign language that was just developed by people in their communities. And then they had a school for the deaf. And then once you have a school for the deaf, then all of a sudden these local languages start to disappear and you get ASL or some version of ASL instead. So ASL is sort of the encroaching language for people who might have learned a local language when they grew up.
Similar to the way English is a bully language.
Right.
Although you may probably know that English, that ASL, American Sign Language, is more similar to French Sign Language than it is to British Sign Language. But don't get us started on it. Just to say that the last language they think that was discovered in Hawaii alone was Hawaiian Sign Language, which just became known about 10 years ago, or at least documented.
Right, right.
So I understand your primary reason for preserving your language is for your own culture. But do you have hopes of sharing your language with other cultures as well? And maybe through an app like Duolingo?
Well, Our primary goal right now, as you said, is to keep this within our communities because, we've seen what happens when our culture can be exploited. You know, there's not a good track record of that, really. So we want to do what we can to keep what's ours within our community. One day, if we do decide to share this outside of, you know, our community, it would be, I think, a healing thing if one day, Chechenyo could be, you know, a prominent spoken language within the Bay Area. But that would have to be something that has community consensus, that's led by our tribal leadership and our elders, first and foremost. And it would be have to be something that's done respectfully, because I think that what happens often is people, they want to feel connected. They want to feel connected to these languages and to the land and all of this. And people who don't have the connection to these places, like how indigenous people do, they often want to know about what is indigenous to this place. But just because you have a curiosity doesn't necessarily make you the right person to learn these things. And I think that there's importance to understand what's sacred, what's important, because we don't want our language to be appropriated. We don't want our language to be, you know, something that we see used casually, because for us it's a sacred thing, it's a living thing, and it connects us to our land and to our ancestors. But in the future, if there ever was a time that was appropriate after our community has enough grounding with the revival, then I think that's something that could have a discussion, but it's not something that one person can decide, and it's not something that can be taken lightly, I don't think.
For myself, I just wanted to add that, like I said in the beginning, I just wanted to be able to sing a song in my language or be able to say a prayer. And it's a little bit more than that now, but I feel like we are sharing it. When I go to a school or when I go to a college, wherever I'm invited, and I share a song in my language, I feel like I am sharing it, because even before, as we introduce a song, we say what it's for and what its meaning is, so that there is some kind of understanding for whoever the public is out there, whatever their language may be. So another instance, people sometimes call just for, they want to know a few words just so they can share. And the example has been, there's been several plays that have been written that include something with Tongva people, and they want that Tongva person to say a word in the language. So I think we are sharing it to an extent, but, there's also the aspect of, you know, I feel like I need to concentrate on our tribal people first.
Pues no quisiéramos ser groseros ni faltar al respeto, pero estamos tratando de que se continúe, en el caso de nosotros los zapotecos, la lengua aquí en Los Ángeles. Y hemos tenido malas experiencias al abrir puertas de nuestras comunidades. En el caso de la Sierra Norte, entraron muchos académicos y al final el reporte de nuestras tierras, de nuestras lenguas, fue entregado al gobierno de Estados Unidos. ¿Por qué? Porque hay minas. ¿Por qué? Porque hay agua. Entonces es una de esas cosas. Quisiéramos que todo el mundo entendiera nuestro mundo, pero también para que de esa manera conozcas tú cómo nosotros nos vemos. Pero también es como un arma de doble filo, porque por la experiencia que hemos tenido en la Sierra Norte, que ahora tenemos que estar perdiendo líderes a la pérdida de las tierras, de las minas, que tienen que estar luchando, porque en alguna vez tuvimos confianza. Es una de esas cosas que es tan difícil, porque no queremos, tenemos grandes aliados como Leanne, como Bob, como Aarón, que nos apoyan para que se continúe la lengua. Pero es una cosa difícil, y creo que, como dice Vince, se tiene que hacer con respeto, pero creo que por ahora nos vamos a enfocar en descolonizarnos nosotros como zapotecos aquí en Los Ángeles, de revalorar nuestra lengua, de decir lo importante que es y de recuperar nuestro mundo que se está perdiendo día a día cuando van generaciones y generaciones que no lo hablan. Entonces creo que ese sería nuestro enfoque.
Hi there. Thank you everyone for coming and speaking of your experiences. I greatly appreciate it. I'm sure the whole audience does. Something I wanted to ask, I am a computational linguist, and something I'm really interested in is language justice and how it relates to language technologies. So I think, you know, that each person has the right to interact, because it's rising, you know, you can talk to your phones now, you can talk to various devices in your home. I think people should be able to do that in their native languages. And if a linguist, say, approached, you know, you and your community, what sort of things should they keep in mind to be culturally sensitive to your needs if they wanted to help you develop ways to interact with technology?
Bueno, nosotros estamos trabajando con Aaron Huey Sonnenschein, pero le decimos Aaron Way Sonnenschein, por lo como se escribe su nombre. Pero lo que... es el único... pobre Aaron, pero no está aquí el día de hoy. Pero es el único que dijimos, ok, güerito, vamos a trabajar contigo, pero bajo nuestras condiciones. Tú nos vas a desarrollar un alfabeto con las fonéticas del inglés. Porque yo no quiero escribir algo que no pueda leer. Tengo muchas cosas en zapoteco de Sogocho, la Biblia, un diccionario que no puedo leer. Entonces decidimos crear algo a nuestras necesidades, pero esto va de la mano con la descolonización, porque usualmente se tiende a pensar, bueno, es un güerito, está estudiado, hay que hacerle caso. Con Aaron le dijimos, no, nosotros vamos a desarrollar nuestro propio vocabulario, queremos hacerlo de la manera que nosotros lo podamos leer y que la gente lo pueda leer. Y si la gente decide escribirlo como ellos quieran, está también lo ajustamos a que ellos lo lean y crear un programa que los niños puedan jugar con eso. Estamos experimentando con eso ahorita, pero esas son como las nuevas reglas. Tienen que ser a beneficio de la comunidad y no para tu librero.
I have... Okay, let me just do say a little bit too, then one more question. Technology can be especially useful to people when the community is in diaspora, and there's certainly many many tribes in the United States that are using social media, that are using. Any kind of technology that would allow people who are in different places to be able to experience the language or communicate with each other. So it can be useful. It's not always useful, but it can be really helpful in diaspora. And I know a number of people who use it that way. So, not necessarily with linguists helping them, though. Okay, one more question.
And then I wanted to just remind you there's a reception in the courtyard. I hope you'll all stay and talk to our guests and explore the antennamobile and the books for sale. And I know at the end, after our question, we'll give this group a great hand. So here's our last question.
Thank you so much. I came to the States in 1975, so it's the mid-70s, and I remember going to school as a child here on the West Side, and I remember it was a very anti-immigrant environment in the 70s, and there weren't any interpreters in the schools, and so I had to interpret Spanish and English for my mom when she came to the schools for any parent conference, open houses, etc. When my kids grew up, when I had my own kids, I, with a collective, worked really hard to get interpreters in the classrooms and the schools and so forth, so parents no longer have to do that. I felt like there was an attack on our cultures back then, and I haven't felt that as I am feeling it, starting to feel it again. And so I hear you all saying that you're hopeful. you're hopeful that your grandkids will pick up the language because your kids didn't or so forth. And I'm wondering if you're feeling the same way about this nationalism that's going on in the conversation currently and what that means to your strides and the steps you've taken forward and whether you feel kind of a threat again.
Who would like to?
Fear, you know, we're talking about fear. We always got to take the step ahead and remove that fear and put it to one side and just take our best step forward. And I think that, you know, as a person who was active and involved with the social movements of the 60s and 70s, yes, you know, that was definitely a time where a lot of change, fortunately, did occur slowly over the years. But I think there was a mental change in some of the people who would have been considered the underdogs at that time. The landscape has changed quite a bit now because a lot of people have, I think, a more open view, and there has been a lot of change, a dramatic change in just in our area here. So I think I don't feel fear, but I feel that there's a time and there's a place, and I think the limits are going to be pushed to where they are, and then the people will speak. And that's what happened in the 60s and 70s. It wasn't planned. It was something that happened out of the outcry of the people. And if it needs to happen again, I think it will.
Bueno, como pueblos originarios, pueblos indígenas, hemos estado luchando por tantos años. Son más de 525 años. Cada presidente en México, en cualquier parte del mundo, llega con las mismas intenciones. Ahora se escucha y es más obvio, pero no es diferente el número 45 que el presidente número 44 o 43 o el número 1. Todos vienen a querer desaparecer los pueblos originarios, a desaparecer nuestras lenguas, nuestras costumbres. Pero ¿saben qué? Hemos luchado tanto tiempo y vamos a seguir. Y vamos a seguir ahora más que nunca. Porque yo me rehúso como mujer zapoteca, como mujer sogochense, ver el mundo de la manera que el número 45 lo ve y de sus malhechores, así les voy a llamar. Todo su equipo de bandidos, me rehúso a ver ese mundo así. Me rehúso a ver el mundo como el número 45. Me rehúso a decir su nombre en público. Porque no voy a permitir que a mi pueblo le meta miedo. Mi pueblo ha resistido y va a continuar resistiendo aquí y en todas partes. Nosotros somos los verdaderos americanos, si quieren llamarnos americanos. Nosotros somos de estas tierras. Somos del pueblo de Aviala y aquí nos vamos a quedar. Y si nuestra lucha es cuesta arriba, lo vamos a llevar y si nos toca morir, moriremos de pie. Pero no vamos a dejar que el número 45 nos meta miedo y ahora es mucho más importante que hablemos y rescatemos de nuestros idiomas y nuestras lenguas. ¿Por qué? Bueno, esto ya va a terminar, esta plática. Pero yo les voy a decir, los voy a ver en unos cuantos soles. No te estoy diciendo te veo en otro día o te veo 15 días. No, te veo, si te veo en 2 semanas, te estoy diciendo te veo en 14 soles o 14 de amaneceres de soles, si quiero ser poética como Bob. Pero no es te veo en 15 días, en 2 semanas. Mi idioma no es tan simple y yo no quiero ser simple como el número 45.
I had one comment as well, and we've really been seeing right now in the Bay Area, in my homeland, I live in Berkeley, and there's been we've been seeing these white nationalist rallies coming in on a pretty regular basis, and the hate and the fear that they're trying to spread is very, it's very tangible. It's very obvious and it's very visible, and it's also very frustrating. But what I feel in my heart is we've survived far worse than this. We know that we come from power. We know we come from strength. We come from people who survived the genocide. We came from people who survived the missions. Every single worst part of the history that has come to us, my family has found a way to survive this. And it's not to brush over the fact that many people, many countless people, did not survive this. And it's important to remember that we come, though, from these powerful people who guide us and allow us to continue our language, to allow this to persist. So when people ask me, I tell them, you know, we'll get through this too. And I think that seeing what's happening right now gives us the pressure to respond. And how do we respond? For me, the way that I respond is by trying to do everything I can to bring back what people are trying to take away, and by breathing that life into language and other aspects of culture. It's important to be able to continue with these things so that, like Virginia was talking about, our future generations and our ancestors will be able to see this and be proud of it. So thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.